This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Ho-Ho Moon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
Tony, what's your favorite Tom Zink match? And why is it any time he tag team with Brian Pillman?
I can't answer that, but I do have a question of my own to ask you. Why have, at the airports, people been stopping me to ask if the rumors are true? Those, of course, being the rumors about me having the hoss and you having the saddle and us liking to ride side by side.
I haven't heard...
That rumor is out there now.
I haven't heard that at my airports that I've been at. You know, no, I've been hearing, though, is that you and the old lady are having problems. Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that, she got the gold mine and you got the shaft.
Mm. Well, you know, that's just your opinion. That's something that...
No, it's not my opinion. This is just what people are telling me at the airports. All the people, when I'm checking, you know how it is. You go to check your luggage or whatever you do at the airport, and now, people come up to you, you know?
Now, Greg, is that just what some people say, or is that what you're saying?
That's what some people are saying. That's just what some people might say. That is what some might say. I'm not saying that. That is not my opinion. I am telling you that others have indicated this to me. I got sources. I still have sources in this business, Nick. I haven't been out of the game that long. I go, oh, GP, he don't know what he's doing no more. Oh, GP, he's out to pasture at this point, 34 years old. Doesn't matter if I'm 34. I am as alert and astute into the happenings on the streets at 34 as I was at 18.
Mm. Which is to say, not at all.
Precisely. Hello, everybody. Welcome.
Hi there.
To the L-Shaped Studios. In Ho-Ho Loon Plaza, in beautiful, I mean, just staggeringly gorgeous Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. We are the hard-traveling fanboys. I am Greg Phillips. He is Nick Duke. And we are here to deliver unto you the latest entry in a series that we cleverly and originally call Countdown. Now, Nick, tell the people why we call this series Countdown.
Because we count down various topics. Top five lists. You know, the famous listicast or listicle, if it were in written form. It used to be in written form, and now it's in a podcast form, so we call it a listicast.
That's right, Reg. That's right, Reg. Now, these lists that we do, we don't collaborate on them, do we, Nick?
No.
We don't share any information beforehand about our list, do we, Nick?
No.
We go in completely blind, and we give you and our cohort our lists fresh as a daisy, as the old expression goes.
As a daisy or fresh as a – some other type of – fresh as a rosebud, perhaps?
Fresh as a rosebud. And you know, Nick, when I think of rosebuds, it gets me in the spirit for chocolate. And we just finished Easter, and you won't find a better chocolate out there. I don't care what anybody tells you. You will not find a better chocolate than a good old-fashioned American Hershey's chocolate.
That's true.
Hershey's chocolate, the official chocolate of the hard chocolate.
You know, the thing about Hershey's chocolate is it's so damn smooth. It's just so smooth, almost like a... God, it's almost like velvet, you know, just so damn smooth.
Yes.
Especially the dark Hershey's chocolate. It's kind of like, you know,
yes.
kind of like black velvet a little bit.
And black velvet, as you know, leads to a strong southern style. But that notwithstanding, Countdown is what we're doing here today, folks. And as we are... We really don't have any timing for this. There's no lie. This is not a particularly timely episode. We're not trying to tie it into any trendy themes in pop culture right now. We don't. The one thing you can never say about the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Well, there's two things you can say about the Hard. Well, there's three things you can never say about the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Number one is that we offer any value whatsoever.
That's right.
Number two is that we come prepared to every episode.
That's right.
And number three thing you can never say about us is that we follow trends, because we don't follow trends, do we, Nick?
No, we are trendsetters, not trend followers. So
we ain't no walk behind, if you will.
No, we're new note finders.
That's right. Now, what are we counting down this month? Let's get to it. Let's tell people what we're counting down. We are counting down in the past, we have counted down our top five favorite Marvel stories, correct, Nick?
Yes, last year.
And our top five DC stories.
Yes, just a few weeks ago.
So what we're doing right now is we're expanding our bubble, if you will. And much like the boy in the plastic bubble, our bubble is pretty small still. But expanding it nonetheless, and we are going to look at our top five, and here's the caveat, non-DC universe or Marvel comics. Now, you would think to yourself, oh, so this is going to encompass all Image and Boom Studios and Dark Horse and things like that. And you may partially be correct, but we are giving ourselves a bit of an out here, Nick, tell the people about our little out that we've given ourselves here.
Our out is that we say DC Universe. That does not mean it wasn't technically published by DC Comics, which means we are, for the purposes of this countdown, we are including Vertigo. And part of the reason we're doing that is because Greg and I, rather than being like some people who have sworn off superhero comics for the most part, we are firmly planted inside the superhero bubble. So we don't really have as much experience as some of the more learned modern-day comic fans with things like Image or like some of the hotter indie comics that are out there. So we have to kind of build this list based on our limited understanding. So for example, something like, say, Sex Criminals, which is a very highly regarded book, probably not going to pop up on either of our lists, because I haven't read it. Greg, have you read it?
Nope.
There you go. Even something as classic as something like Sandman, I haven't read it, so it's not going to be on my list. And I know that's sacrilegious to a lot of hardcore comic fans, but just never gotten around to it. So this may be something of an incomplete list. It's far from definitive, but it's the best list we can give you at this point. And if I had to bet, I'd imagine they're going to be fairly similar, at least in terms of the books that are on them.
Yes, particularly
at the top.
The
order. Yes.
We also we're not just including Vertigo, we're also including Marvel's Epic Comics imprint, which included books of this kind. But they're books that take place outside the mainstream, basically, is what we're talking about. Non-traditional superhero books set in the traditional superhero universes. So pretty interesting Danny hodgepodge of genres you might find here. Some genres that might make you go, and others that might make you go, ho-ho, wow!
Indeed they might, but no
and
better.
Oddly enough, some that might make you go, ho-ho-loon!
Ho-ho-loon, indeed. And with all that being said, I guess there's no better time than the present. Greg, tell the people your number five selection.
So my number five selection, it was a very difficult choice for me, Nick, because I had two books that I was juggling for this number five spot. And even up to this moment, I've been volleying them in my head, badminton with myself, you might say, as I hit the shuttlecock back and forth in my mind. Shuttlecock. I ultimately came up with this book as number five, and when we get done, if you'd like, we can talk about some of the books that maybe just missed our cuts, if you will. But my number five book comes to us from Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples at Image Comics. It is Saga. And this is actually a currently ongoing series. So this is a book that's hitting your stands all the time now, and it's just an ongoing story by this creative team of Staples and Vaughn, who, just to tell tales out of Skule for a moment, Brian K. Vaughn had three books that very nearly made my list. I ended up with two of his books on my list, but he is a tremendous writer, particularly on the indies. And Saga is the best way I could sum it up would be to – it's almost doing it a disservice to say this, but it's a – it is a space opera in the Star Wars sense of the word. But it's not just Star Wars. There's not really a lot of fighting per se, space fighting anyway. It's really – it's like the Lord of the Rings mixed with Star Wars, which I've said for Green Lantern a lot, but where Green Lantern throws in elements of James Bond or Lethal Weapon – this throws in elements of a family drama because really at its heart, at its core, this is a story about a family. And Saga has been going on for several years now. Started around, I believe, 2011, if I'm not mistaken. And it tells the story of this these kind of literally star-crossed lovers that are raising a baby in a situation where they are lovers that come from different sides of intergalactic war. So when I say there's not a lot of fighting, there is a lot of fighting. There is a war going on, but it's not a book that is really based on that fighting. And it's no surprise that Star Wars is a big influence in this series. It's kind of – maybe – we've talked about Green Lantern being the closest thing that we have to Star Wars in comics, but really this is – along those same lines, even more so perhaps, because of the focus on the family of Alana, Marco, and the girl, the little girl, Hazel, that they're trying to raise. But it's just a weird, wacky adventure story that has all of these crazy alien races and alien creatures, intergalactic travel, just weird situations that pop up. There is a character named Prince Robot the Fourth who has a television for a head and is seen in the first issue taking a dump. But all this wackiness and weirdness, at its core, it's a family drama about, you know, relationship problems, these two lovers who are not supposed to be together. And as you see, Alana and Marco kind of try to overcome their people's prejudices, their histories, their own stubbornness to try to raise their little girl and escape together throughout this crazy universe. It's incredible to read. And I, in full disclosure, I've only read the first, I think, three volumes mm-hmm. of Saga, so I've got a lot more to read. But what I've read is excellent. And I've actually bought a couple more volumes. I think I've bought through volume 5, and I just haven't gotten around to reading them yet. But it's not for lack of want, because this is one of the best new books that I read in the last 10 years, easily. And just blew me away when I read the first volume. Excited to see what else happens in this universe and what kind of changes have happened since the last time I checked in.
Yeah, I agree with all of that, so much so that while I have only read two volumes, I will actually be speaking more about Saga a little later on in this show, as it made my list a little bit higher than it did for you. But here's one that I know you will have on your list and have higher than I have on my list. My number 5 selection is also a book from Brian K. Vaughan. This one with art from Pia Guerra for Vertigo Comics, which began back in 2002. And that is, of course, Why the Last Man, the story of Yorick Brown, the literal last man on Earth after a mysterious plague wipes out every male on the planet, leaving only Yorick and his pet monkey Ampersand to roam the planet in search of his long-lost girlfriend, trying to basically become the planet's only hope for natural repopulation, even though we later find out that cloning apparently is a viable solution. But this is just an epic book that has, you know, that's one thing about these non-Big Two books that most superhero titles aren't able to have. They're able to have beginnings, middles, and ends. And Why the Last Man is a perfect example of that, in that it is one story told over 60 issues, and it is everything comes full circle by the end. You have a satisfactory ending for all the characters. And along the way, you get these these memorable antagonists. You get a burgeoning relationship that you don't even realize is a burgeoning relationship until near the end of the title. You get humor, you get action, you get drama, you get so much rolled up in these 60 issues. And it's really remarkable that such a simplistic concept like, you know, one man left on Earth is able to provide so many memorable characters, because you would think it would be, you know, it would have a tendency to lend itself to repetitiveness, and it doesn't.
Right.
It is very unique. It keeps you on the edge of your seat throughout. And, you know, Brian K. Vaughan writes every character perfectly. The art from Pia Guerra is absolutely phenomenal. And it's one of the best examples of the heyday of Vertigo. It's kind of sad that pretty much since the end of this one back in 2008, Vertigo's stature in the comics community has kind of been weakened severely, I would argue. And it's possible we might look back on this one 10, 15, 20 years from now as the last great Vertigo title. I hope that isn't the case. But right now, it looks like that certainly is a possibility for this one's legacy in comics history.
It's so good, and I'll revisit it a little bit later on as well, but it's so good that it will make you care emotionally about a pet monkey named Ampersand.
Yes.
And I don't want to say any more than that about that, but good pick, Nick, and one that with the first example of our list, or the second example, I guess, of our list having crossover with one another. Mm-hmm. Well, for my number four pick, I've got a book that I'm fairly sure won't be on your list because you haven't read it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I have only read the first, again, two, maybe three volumes of this.
Mm-hmm.
But suffice it to say, it made a huge impact on me when I read it just a couple years ago. And it's one that we have had slated for a long book hunt for a while. We just haven't gotten around to it yet. And that is a book by the tremendous team of Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips, and it's a book called Fatal. And this is a title that comes to us from Image Comics, and it is one of the most unique books that I've come across in comics. And again, it's actually technically, I think, incomplete. It's still, if I'm not mistaken, no, maybe it has wrapped up. I'm checking on that right now, folks. Yes, it is. It is wrapped up, but it was one of the craziest things but one of the most interesting stories I've read. It actually takes you back, as the title would indicate, Femme Fatale, but it's called Fatale, and it takes you back to this woman named Josephine who happens to pop up in all these different timelines. We see her in back in the 1940s, in the heyday of film noir and things like that. But then we have almost a dual timeline narrative going on in the first volume, where the character in present day sees a woman that looks stunningly like this Josephine that he's seen in pictures. Well, it turns out she was back in the 40s. She is actually immortal. Or seemingly immortal. And as the book unfolds, and each volume takes you to a different time period in Josephine's life while balancing it with present day stuff, you get to see how her kind of immortality came to be, and that perhaps it's more of a curse than a blessing, and exactly what caused that curse to be placed upon her. And the it starts out looking like it's going to be kind of a by the numbers, you know, 40 style detective story, but rapidly it becomes apparent that you're not dealing with just a 40 or like a noir detective story. You're also dealing with a supernatural horror as well. And so this book actually blends those sensibilities, which are two strong sensibilities, that kind of flair for the detective side of things that Brubaker has shown in the past, with a strong supernatural horror sensibility that I don't think that I had seen in his work before I read this. And it is exceptional. Like the first two, I think I've read the first two volumes, and you get to see the 40s, the present day, and then the second volume you see the 50s and the 60s. Sorry, the 30s and the 60s. And the way that the art is in these books from Sean Phillips, it's evocative of that time period. If it's in the 40s, it looks like what you've seen in the films, Jimmy Cagney films or whatever. And then it's like it goes to the 60s. It looks like a swinging 60s story, you know, a little more light, a little more colorful. At the 70s, very gritty and you know, hard-boiled, like the some of the 70s movies you might have seen, like Chinatown or something. And it's just an exceptional book. I can't wait for you to read it one day, Nick, because I think you're going to love it as much as I did, or almost as much as I did. These two guys have had a lot of books. I've read a few of them. Criminal's really good. I read the first volume of Criminal, and it was great. But this is the one that made my list, because of all the books on this list, this one actually has the best chance to climb my list, I think, even perhaps over Saga, which is amazing, just because this one is so, I guess, in my wheelhouse.
Indeed. You did loan me the first volume. I am looking forward to getting to it at some point and us reviewing it on these very airwaves. I am a fan of the other work of Brubaker's I've read. I'm not as familiar with a lot of Sean Phillips' work, but definitely something I'm looking forward to checking out one day. But speaking of things that we've reviewed on these very airwaves, my number four is a selection that I'm not going to spend too much time talking about, because you can actually go not that far back in the archives and find us talking about it at length. And that is a book that is still ongoing. There's only 20 issues out now.
We also talk about it at Girth, I think.
Indeed. There's only four trades. I've only read two of the trades, but that book is Jason Aaron and Jason Latour's Southern Bastards. As we mentioned in our full-length review of the first volume, I have not encountered a comic or arguably a piece of art in general since To Kill a Mockingbird way back in the 1950s that so perfectly encapsulates the good, the bad, and the ugly of living it through in the South, living in the South, and filters it through a somewhat comedic lens. Like it, this book is so well done. It is not a parody of the people who live here or the way of life that is represented here, but more a somewhat critical examination rather than an outright mocking, in my view. You combine that with a somewhat noirish story, even though it's set in backwoods Alabama, and very distinctive art from Jason Latour, and it all combines for a finished product that feels familiar and yet strange to me at the same time, and has me absolutely hooked based on the two volumes I've read. I can't wait to see what else is out there. I know that, like I said, I've only read, I think, 9 of the 20 issues that are out, but this one absolutely earns the spot on the list for me, and it's one that I am very much looking forward to carving out the time to see where it goes from here. Fantastic characters, fantastic writing, hard to say too much else. If you want more in-depth thoughts, like I said, go back and check out our previous episode on it.
In the archives. Embarrassed, Nick, that I actually blanked on this when I was making my list. I was drawing my list up earlier, and I completely friggin' forgot about Southern Bastards. I feel bad about that. I'm not sure if it would have made the list, but it damn sure would have been in consideration. Mm-hmm. So that was I guess you might say I committed a boner.
Mm. I think, you know, that your brain was full of dew when you were making your list, and so.
Sorry, guys, I'm sick right now. And
as your chest is also full of dew.
Yes, as Nick has forced me to laugh, it brought a cough to my chest, as to paraphrase Ric Flair. But you know, I want to pause here and take an aside, Nick, that just crossed my mind. We both before this show agreed that we were not including Watchmen in this because it was technically published by DC Comics, mm-hmm, under the DC Comics label. However, it occurs to me that when we were doing our top 5 DC stories, we also excluded Watchmen, which probably would have been my number one. So,
well, it's such is life. We all know how we stand on Watchmen. You know, obviously we're huge fans, seeing as how we have had the goodness in our hearts to take it and actually improve upon it with comic book theater. So, I mean, clearly we have a high regard for it. We wouldn't have done something like that to something that we hated. You know, we would only do something like that to something that we loved.
We love, exactly. And you know, we particularly took some of Alan Moore's ideas about the character of Captain Metropolis, and I think really, really improved upon that character and what was there. But nonetheless, that actually does tie in to my number 3 selection, Nick, because this is one that I'm particularly proud of, because I would have left this one out until I looked into it. My number three selection comes to us from Alan Moore and David Lloyd, and it is V for Vendetta.
Oh, man. I've committed a boner.
Yes, we have both committed boners, and it has nothing to do with watching an Avengers movie.
No.
Now, I originally wasn't going to include Vendetta because my volume had DC Comics on it, but I looked into it, and it was originally published in an anthology series in the UK called Warrior, which had no ties to DC.
That is correct.
So it technically counts, and Alan Moore's V for Vendetta makes our list. Now, this is another book that we have talked at length about, but I believe that was in our column days. Is that correct, Nick?
That is correct, yes, where I had the controversial opinion that I actually think I like it better than Watchmen, but yes, I am a massive fan of V for Vendetta. If I had not committed this serious boner, I probably would have had it number one or number two on my list.
Yeah, it's it is spectacular. I mean, if you go back and find that column, which can be found on PlaceToBeNation.com, you search for the Longbook Hunters and find V for Vendetta. We kind of set our piece on it then, but it's a masterpiece. There's no other way about it. It's a black and white story by David Lloyd, very rigid layouts, but yet the art is incredible and it stands out in your mind. I can picture it even as we're talking about it, Nick. It's been 2 years since I've read that book, and I can still vividly picture the characters, the scenes as they played out in the book. And it is almost a manifesto of sorts from Alan Moore. It touches on all sorts of political and ideological points of view. It's almost a 1984 for comics, if that makes sense. It's very Orwellian, and it goes into a lot of uncomfortable territory for what you would expect for comic books and even beyond that. And if you've seen the movie, which I happen to think the movie is very good, but the movie is actually a much softer version of what you get in the comic.
Yes, I would agree completely.
The comic asks even tougher questions of its audience. Nothing is black and white in the comic.
And
art itself.
I was about to say, and has much deeper shades of gray that tend to skew more towards the darker side of that spectrum for virtually every character in the book, perhaps with the exception of Evie. But even by the end, she is not as lily white as you would be led to believe by the events of the movie.
She's somewhat of a Jezebel.
Somewhat. Now, I would like to point out, you're mentioning black and white. For the collected edition, DC has colorized that art in recent – in pretty much since it was printed in trade paperback form.
True. So you can get it with colored art. I don't know how I feel about that. I don't really have a huge issue with it, I guess. But I think there is something about that black and white that starkly affected me.
And I'm fairly sure that my edition that I have is colorized. But I don't know that for a fact. I'd have to go pick it up off my bookshelf. And that's just too much fucking work.
Right. But I will say, if black and white comics bother you, you're not a big fan, get the colored edition. And the colors are not like – it's not like everything popping off the page.
No, they intentionally colored it in pastels to try and maintain some of that. Like, while it wasn't going to be black and white because the colors were very muted, you were going to have a different visual tone about it than you would with your average full-color comic. So
yes. And I've read it in black and white and in color, and both are great. And if you really want to read a book and kind of get an idea as to why, if you've read Watchmen and you're like, okay, this is great, but give me something else to indicate what a genius Alan Moore is, this is the book to pick up, because you may start and you'll be like, oh gosh, this is going to be a long, boring slog. It's long, but it ain't boring at all. So that is my number three selection.
An excellent selection on your part. As I mentioned, only not on my list because of because of my massive boner, of course.
Yes. Well, let's not go too far.
Well, you know, it was a pretty big boner, Greg, I'd have to say.
It was fair sized.
I think blanking on that is a big boner. Now, that's just me. I think it deserves consideration as a big boner.
Now, do you think that it's the – I mean, well, let's just move on. I don't want to go any further down this rabbit hole. or this boner hole, if you will. This glory hole, if you will.
This glory hole, yes. This glorious hole. Moving on to my number three selection, a book that we have also reviewed for the old column back in the day, and a book that I know absolutely will not make your list. This is comes to us from Marvel's Icon imprint, and this, of course, is Kick-Ass, written by Mark Miller and illustrated by John Romita Jr. This came out back in, oh man, I want to say 2008, and ran for 2 years. It was an 8-issue limited series that came out bi-monthly. And I've, for the purposes of including this on my list, I am only counting the initial mini-series, Kick-Ass. While Kick-Ass 2 is okay, fair, and Kick-Ass 3 I actually haven't read yet, the original Kick-Ass to me is a fantastic comedic story that kind of takes on a fairly common trope in the comics world. I mean, there have been lots of takes on the what if somebody tried to do the superhero thing in real life story. Many writers have taken it on, but I, for my money, I think Mark Miller's take on it is kind of my favorite. And the reason why is because, yes, you have to portray that or ask that question and have some sort of grittiness to the story, but he manages to almost turn it into black comedy along the way. We get lots of over-the-top humor. You get the introduction of the characters of Hit Girl and Big Daddy, who are just, you know, epically over-the-top and really hilarious. You get Dave, the lead character, Dave Lazowski, and his borderline pathetic friends who reminded me a lot of certain other individuals that I hung out with in college, but I'm not going to say their names. I found a lot to relate to in this book. And so the idea of someone even as pathetic as Dave, which is to say even as pathetic as myself, being able to make a positive difference in the world was something I really enjoyed. Great book that kind of subverts expectations at various points along the way. Something that I would argue the movie doesn't do nearly as well, and is why the movie isn't as good as the comic, in my opinion. But still, a highly entertaining read. It's one I recommend to anyone who enjoys some humor in their books, who enjoys a little grotesque violence in their books, and who enjoys 11-year-old girls using words like fuck and cunt in their books. So if you like those sorts of things, check out Kick-Ass. You will not be disappointed.
Well, we're earning our mature rating this week, Nick.
Well, quite frankly, you don't want to go just a small amount over the explicit rating. I mean, I don't know what that amount would be if there was a term for it, but you want to go above and beyond.
Yes, you don't want to go just a frog's hair.
Frog's hair. That's it. Frog's hair.
Well, my number two selection is also a bit of a mature title, and it's one that's already been on your list. My number two selection comes from Brian K. Vaughan, his second book on my list, and artist P. Aguera, and that is Why the Last Man. And Why the Last Man, as Nick covered, is the story of literally the last man on Earth, and really about all the women who are left as a result of how they respond to there being one man left on Earth and what that man means in terms of his value to society and how it will move forward. So this series, I first heard about it actually through the old CWO, Blog of Doom, from some of our friends, Kyle Morton and a few others like that were reading it at the time. And eventually,
it's still weird to me to hear CWO people referred to by their shoot names. It's odd.
That's true. Yeah, like, he was Noir et Blanc.
Yeah, I'm saying in the context of like that specific discussion, it's still jarring to me somewhat.
It is. I agree with you on that. And that's kind of how I first heard about it. And finally, I found the first volume on sale somewhere, and decided, what the hell, I'll give it a try and see how it is. And so, bought the first volume, sat down with it, and by the end of it, I had to know what happens to Yorick Brown, the lead character. He is one of the most well-rounded and best lead characters in an original comic series I've ever read, flat out. I mean, whether it's his relationships, his quirks, his unique sense of humor that no one else seems to get, except Ampersand, I guess, his pet monkey. Whether it is the gradually growing list of side characters, some of whom have sinister motivations, the villains that are they really villains or are they doing what they need to do to survive? It's just an epic series that hooks you at the end of every volume to make you want to see what comes next, but yet it doesn't fall victim to that shock value trend where everything's just shock value after shock value. There are big surprises and big shocks along the way, but the shocks aren't the point of everything. They just serve the greater narrative. And to show you how invested in that first volume I became, after reading it, I bought the second volume and read that. And then after reading that, I was all in. So I went and I bought volume 3, volume 4, volume 5, volume 6, volume 7, volume 8, volume 9, and volume 10. So I ended up buying all 10 trades of this. They are valued parts of my collection. And for me, it's one of the greatest comic book series of all time, and I really want to see it get adapted, but more importantly, I want it to be adapted right, which means I want to see it as a series on a premium channel, like HBO, Showtime, something like that, or even FX, something like that. But I want it to be a series rather than a standalone movie, which is what I'm afraid is going to happen.
Actually, I believe it's in development at FX. I could be wrong about that, but I think I read the Wikipedia page for it earlier whenever I was prepping my list, and I think I read something about that on there. So
there was a canceled film adaptation. Mm-hmm. In November 2016, Michael Green was announced to be the showrunner for Why the Last Man for FX. So very cool. Okay, awesome. I didn't actually know that, but that's great.
Now, 2016, that's a long time ago, especially in the TV world where things tend to move a little bit faster. So if we haven't seen anything of it, I don't know if that means it's still in development or not. But as you know, with the information we have in front of us, with the ultra-reliable Wikipedia that's in front of us, we are being told that it is currently in development. So let's hope that actually winds up happening. Moving on to my number two, and from one Brian K. Vaughan book that I had already talked about to a Brian K. Vaughan book that you had already talked about. And much like Southern Bastards, I've only read the first two volumes of Saga. But for all the reasons that Greg mentioned earlier, this thing, much like Fatale was for Greg, is so damn in my wheelhouse that it had to rank and rank very highly for me. Greg drew the natural parallels to Star Wars, and it is very much like Star Wars in the regard of having this immersive, deep universe with all these implied, you know, histories and backstories that aren't fully revealed, but you get the impression that the story we are watching play out is just the latest thread in a massive tapestry that spans across the universe. When you add into that the family dynamic that Greg also mentioned, it combines together to create something that is as for me as anything I've ever read in the world of independent comics. Again, only read the first two volumes, due largely to time reasons, financial reasons, and just resources. But I am fully intending on getting caught up with this at my earliest possible convenience, and I look forward to discussing Saga more. I believe we did a column on the first volume, but have not done anything else on the rest of it. I am looking forward to potentially picking that back up at some point in the future, but Greg pretty much laid out all the reasons perfectly. This thing is just amazing. The writing of Brian K. Vaughan, the art of Fiona Staples, characters like Prince Robot the Fourth, and one of my personal favorites, Lion Cat, just combined together to make this something that truly must be read to be understood or to be experienced. It is completely unlike anything I've read, and it's something that everyone should at least try out, even if you don't think it would be for you.
Nick, what would happen in your household if you had Lion Cat as a pet?
Well, because I am the only male in my house, I feel like he would spend a lot of time telling the other women that they are lying because that is their nature in life.
Good Lord. Good Lord. I was thinking more in regards to the little white lies you have to tell the children. And again, who knows?
Lion Cat is probably a very useful thing in parenting, I would imagine.
Yes, yes. Which one of you did it? It was Gwen.
Lying.
So I think we should go ahead and let the cat out of the bag. I'm just making an assumption here, Nick. Tell me if I'm jumping over my bounds here, but I feel like we both have the same number one.
I think that's a safe assumption to make, my friend. I think, you know, I think it is.
And that number one selection, which is shared by both of us, is Grant Morrison's The Invisibles.
Indeed. Or Grant Morrison's Animal Man, I think we should say.
Oh, yes, that was a Vertigo title at first, yes. But no, actually our number one title is Preacher by Garth Ennis and the late, great Steve Dillon.
Mm-hmm.
No surprise to those who have followed us for a long time, I don't think. This is a book that I don't even remember how I first discovered it. I think our mutual friend Jeremy and our mutual friend Sam may have.
I remember it being Sam for some reason. Not to say Jeremy hasn't introduced us to a lot of other things and not to deny him any credit he may be due, but I primarily remember Sam as being the driving interest in or driving force behind getting us to read it. And when you consider some of the subject material, I think that makes a lot of sense given people who know Sam.
Yes, Sam was adamant that I needed to read it, that I would love it if I gave it a chance. And I finally did by borrowing, actually. And I remember I borrowed all of – I was getting them conflated because they both were in the Huntsville region at the time. But I borrowed Sam's volumes of Preacher to read it.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't get enough. I just could not get enough.
I think those same trades made the way around our entire friend group pretty – pretty much everybody borrowed them at some point, and they were they were great. I mean, I know I read that was my first exposure to them. I now have my own entire collected edition of the reissued trades that are actually condensed into fewer volumes. But yeah, I think my experience with it is very much the same as yours.
Yes, Sam turned us on to it, and I'm very thankful that he did because it is a transformative comic book series. It's so good. In so many ways. I feel like we've talked about it a lot on our show before and in our columns and things like that. But it's just I hesitate to use the term brilliant, but it's really brilliant from beginning to end. We talked about with Why the Last Man, with some of these other stories, Fatale, that they have a beginning, middle, and an end, which is something you very rarely get to do in superhero comics, if ever. But I think no book illustrates that better than Preacher. Ennis and Dillon got how many issues, Nick? 80?
Something like that, yeah. It's not as simple as Why the Last Man because it has some standalones, some specials, you know, that sort of thing. I'm looking now. So let's see. There are 66 main issues and 5 special issues for 71 and then a 4-part miniseries. So 75 if you're including them all there together.
75 issues, which take place over the course, the better part of a decade. You know, it's five years. And they tell a complete and cohesive story, create an entire cast of characters from the ground up, make you care about these characters, flesh them out to the point where they get their own, the side characters get their own standalone stories, like Arseface, the Saint of Killers.
Mm-hmm.
Jody and TC, they get their Cassidy. their own side stories.
John Custer.
Cassidy, of course, John Custer, yes, absolutely, who made our greatest dads list at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And it just creates this tapestry of characters and settings that is simultaneously, and let's go ahead and get this out of the way, the funny comic book I've ever read in my life.
Yeah, I would agree. It's absolutely hilarious. And, you know, that's the thing, though, about this book is it's not going to be for a lot of people. Like, for example, there are books that I'm a advocate for the comics medium, and there are books I feel comfortable handing to anyone and saying, check this out. Maybe you'll like this. This is kind of what comics are all about. This is not one of those. And I don't say that to be a criticism of the book.
Right.
I'm just saying it is certainly an acquired taste. It is something that is not going to be for everybody. Case in point, I had my wife read it at one point, and not a fan. Not a fan, to say the least. And that's something that if we're being honest, kind of surprised me with your love for it, because it does deal with a lot of religious material, and you tend to be a bit more conservative in that regard than I do in terms of what the humorous aspects of it and what you're willing to put up with.
Right. Yes. It's one of those things where the Kevin Smith movie Dogma could be seen kind of the same way. A lot of people, when it came out, were up in arms about it, and I watched it, and I kind of took it differently. To me, there's no getting around the fact that if you are – it is extremely sacrilegious. If you're a hardcore Christian or even just a moderate Christian, it's a sacrilegious book on that front. But also, I think you have to be willing to look at things that critique your belief system and see what you can take away from that. Because what this is it points out not – it's taking a humorous – satirical look at a literal interpretation of the Bible. God, the devil, angels, all that stuff. But it's also using it to analyze human behavior and the way people react to different situations. And so it does it in a way that is so entertaining and that is so over the top that I couldn't spend time being offended because I was enjoying myself too much. It was just too much fun, and I agree with you, Nick. I wouldn't recommend it to everybody, but I think for me, it's not. And the thing about it is, it's not just a funny book, because that's kind of what tricks you is you think, oh, it's just hilarious. It's absolutely hysterical. That's the level I most enjoy it on. But beyond that, it's about people.
Right. It's an incredibly poignant love story for one. Yep. It's an incredibly fascinating story about how a relationship between two friends can evolve and fall apart and come back together. As crazy as it is to say, the friendship between a vampire and a man who's imbued with the power of the voice of God is one of the most realistic interpretations of male friendship that I've seen in a comic book. It's so well done because it nails a lot of that guy dynamic. And so there are various things about it besides just the humor that work on a more emotional and genuine level.
Yes, and it's the relationship of Jesse and Tulip. It's fathers and sons throughout the book. It's the sort of notion of masculinity of what that means. It's connections, personal connections to things, to nostalgia or to abstract ideas or whatever. And it encompasses what the medium can accomplish to me. Like in a way that it's not trying to do necessarily what Watchmen did, but in a different way, it's showing you what comics are capable of, that they're making you laugh, they can make you cry, they can make you feel on a lot of different levels, and it's kind of one of the crowning achievements for that for me. Like, when I got to that final issue, I almost didn't want to read it because I didn't want it to end. I didn't want the journey to end that I had seen to that point. But it ends in a spectacular fashion, and it has just a litany of incredible dialogue, and again, just one of the most entertaining pieces of fiction I think I've ever encountered.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, so many memorable characters you meet along the way, even outside of the core three of Jesse, Tulip, and Cassidy. I mean, you have just unforgettable side characters like Odin Kincannon, like Grandma Langell, like Jody and TC, Arseface, of course, the Saint of Killers, Hair Star, All-Father Daranique, the Messiah. I mean, like, it is a book where almost every issue is introducing you to some new character or concept, and it's one that hits almost every single one of them out of the park. It's very rare to see a comic bat 1,000, but this one pretty much does.
Exactly. Totally agreed. And that kind of brings us to the end of our countdown, actually, right now. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to touch on maybe a few of the books that
there's one in particular that I'm highly surprised is not on your list.
And I think I know the one that you're talking about because I have it here listed as number 6, and it was the one that I was going back and forth on for that number 5 spot.
Uh-huh.
And that is Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Risso's 100 Bullets.
Yep, it was also on my preliminary list, and I wound up having to take it off. The other one I also considered I had three others that I considered, those being 100 Bullets, Irredeemable, and
yes.
Oh, what was the other one? I'm blanking. I know there was another one, though. It'll come to me eventually.
Yeah, I 100 Bullets is one that I love, mm-hmm. but I think it's been so long since I've read it because I kind of was stoned. I couldn't find one of the volumes, and so I was stonewalled at like volume 6 for a while. Finally got volume 7, and I haven't gone back to read it yet. So mm-hmm. That's probably the reason that I didn't miss. But I love it. Great, gritty series that, again, interesting ideas, very cool art, very cool kind of street level storytelling. And then, of course, you mentioned it with, and I've just drawn a blank. What was the one that you just mentioned?
Irredeemable.
Irredeemable, yeah, Mark Irredeemable, which is a superhero story, but a kind of superhero story you're unlikely to get told that well in a mainstream universe because he kind of takes that old trope of what if Superman went bad but explores it to the extreme end of the spectrum and does it in a way that it almost feels inevitable that you're going to get a depressing ending. And it goes to some pretty dark places through the it's the darkest thing that Mark Waid's ever written.
I would tend to agree. The other one I considered was one you weren't as high on, and that was The Wicked and the Divine by Kieran Gillen. I've read two volumes of that. Big fan of that as well. But for me, I felt pretty confident in my 5. I like 100 Bullets. I don't think I like it as much as you do, so it wasn't as agonizing a decision to leave it off my list. The only thing I agonized over on this list was including things that I haven't read more of, and it just highlighted to me the fact that I need to read more Saga, I need to read more Southern Bastards, and I'm looking forward to doing that hopefully in the near future.
And when you do, we'll be sure to talk about it right here on the longest running
weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
So what do you think of our list, folks? Do you have a more informed list? Would you like to comment on our list? Let us know.
Yes, I am sure that the exclusion of Sandman is causing eyes to twitch throughout our listening community.
Well, let us know. We want to hear it. Tweet us at gphillips8652. Tweet us at nickduke87. Join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Gosh, what else? Oh, yes, email gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. Let us know your thoughts. Let us know what you're thinking about the whole deal here, your lists. Give us your list. We want your list. Give it to us now. Give us your holds. And in the meantime, please stay with us as you listen to these advertisements for some of the other great podcasts here at Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop, including our good friends Geek and Sassy, Sellers Points, Talk and Pop, Sunday Groove.
Easy Like David Sunday.
And Conversation Comics and others. So be sure to stick through and listen to the commercials. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on 3 great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
We are back, ladies and gentlemen, from the break. And before we go any further in this broadcast, I would like to throw a shout out to a gentleman who listens to our show on Twitter. He is Geek and Eats. He is at Hal2814. We appreciate any feedback from the audience, and to show how much we appreciate it, I'm going to follow through on what I told him I would do last week and forgot, which is when we did our countdown of our favorite DC stories just a few weeks ago, he actually submitted to us his list of his favorite DC stories, and his list go a little something like this. At number 5, he has Green Lantern Rebirth. At number 4, he has Blackest Night. At number 3, he has Justice League, The New Frontier. At number 2, he has Batman Year One. And at number 1, he has Identity Crisis. So, shout out, Geek and Eat. Thank you for giving us your feedback. For all of you, give us your feedback. We will try our best to mention them on the show. I know we've got some on our Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page that I haven't mentioned, but we will get to those at some point in the future as well. So, with all that being said, let's move on to our longest-running segment here on this show, and that is, of course, reading and watching.
Reading and watching. What you be reading and watching.
What you been reading and watching.
Nick, how far back are we going? I don't even know.
We're, you know, for simplicity's sake, we're just going to talk about this past week's episodes. You know, we have been behind. That's partially, or not partially, entirely my fault due to some circumstances that I had to work through over the last month or so. So rather than trying to be convoluted and catch up, we're just going to move right along to this past week's episodes of CW television. We are not going to discuss Walking Dead this week because I am 3 weeks behind at the point, and we hope to be able to bring you Walking Dead thoughts at the very least in time for the season finale in 2 weeks. We will do everything in our power to make sure that happens. But for this for these purposes, we are going to be discussing simply this week's episodes of Legends of Tomorrow, Black Lightning, and The Return of Arrow.
Yes, so Legends of Tomorrow last week took us to a planet of Avas. Mm-hmm. And we finally learned about the the origin, the background of the Time Bureau agent, Ava, who has been the lover of Sarah Lance, the leader of our team of rogues. And we discover that Ava's backstory is different than she or anybody else thought, and that she is actually one of a planet of clones, or not that the entire planet are clones, but that she is in a universe or on a world or a timeline, rather, where in this timeline they have created her as a clone and spawned thousands of her that are just everywhere doing every job imaginable. So, kind of an interesting, unique twist, and it leads to the usual hijinks from the Legends crew, just continual entertainment value on that level, and this show just continues to kick all kinds of ass, Nick.
Yeah, I agree completely. I know you and I both were very skeptical about this Ava character back when the show first started this season, but we have come around on her greatly. And I wound up really digging this episode, and I'm very much a fan of the her and Sarah dynamic, and I hope it continues going forward, which is something we will be talking about a little bit later during the rundown. So big thumbs up for me on Legends this week. Continues to be the most consistent of the CW shows this season.
Yeah, it's been great. So that was terrific. Tuesday night, well, we should mention The Flash is currently on an unexplained and inexplicable break in the middle of their season, so go figure. And so that brings us to Black Lightning on Tuesday night. And Black Lightning is another show that has really continued to ramp things up. It went through a little lull there for an episode or two, but it got back on the driver's seat, back in the driver's seat really quick. And the last several episodes, I think, have been excellent. And particularly this past week, where we finally get a little bit of character development or a little bit of explanation for Gambi, the character that has kind of been the one sticking point for me on this show to this point, because I think the actor, and I still stand by this, I don't think the actor is doing a great job at playing the character, but I will say they went a long way to explaining why he's the way he is and a little bit about his background. We continue to see the family of Jefferson Pierce as they continue to develop powers. Both of his daughters now have powers, including his youngest daughter having powers very similar to his. Meanwhile, Thunder, his other daughter, continues to do her superhero thing and really kind of grow into her own. And we continue to layer the villains, as now you've got this shady government agent who's played by an actor who qualifies as that guy. In that he's that guy that I've seen in a lot of different things, but I can't place his name. But I've seen a bunch of things. And then you've got the resurrected Lala, that's the one area of the show that has gotten no explanation, but I'm hoping they get to it soon because it's very fascinating. And he's a great character, as we talked about earlier.
I would think it has to do something with the combined effects of green light and whatever it was that Lady Eve was doing to those corpses in various scenes,
yes.
Right? Like, that has to play a role somehow.
I think so. And and you would assume that Lala probably had green light used on him when he was a kid, mm-hmm. You know? So we also, and then of course, somewhere out there, and I don't know has his absence been explained, Tobias Hoyle?
Yeah, if it has, I guess I completely glossed over that.
Yeah,
I thought he was in hiding because of like some events that had happened. He was worried about, you know, people.
But they pinned it on Black Lightning.
Yeah,
you know, Lady Eve. So,
and I don't know the answer.
That's what I don't get.
Don't know the answer to that question, Greg.
There were a couple of things that happened during the hiatus that I didn't really understand why they happened off screen, but nonetheless, I thought this was a really good episode, Nick. I really enjoyed it. I'm continuing to enjoy this show. It's the acting is for the most part very good, and the story is really compelling.
Yeah, I would agree completely. You know, like you said, getting some forward momentum finally on the Gambi subplot, although it's kind of been replaced in its lack of momentum with the Lala thing. While I enjoy having Lala back, I am starting to get to the point where we need something more than just cryptic behavior to hook us back into that character and give us an understanding of what purpose he is serving in the story right now. So here's hoping that we will get all the subplots moving forward as Black Lightning is getting pretty close to the end. I think it's only got like 3 or 4 episodes left in its first season, because I think it's a 13-episode order for season one. So hopefully things will start to pick up a little bit more steam here in the coming weeks.
And then, of course, Thursday brings us to Starling City and or Star City, I should say, and Arrow. And we kind of wrap up a 2-episode arc involving the return of Roy Harper and the return to activity of Thea Queen as Speedy. This also sees the return of Nyssa, who I know we always love when she appears on the show. She has been missed, and the League of Assassins, or rather an offshoot of the League of Assassins, known as, Nick?
The Thanatos Guild. Thanatos Guild. Which is false advertising if there ever was any.
Yeah. Now, Nick, I have to confess that I have a bit of an ailment right now.
Oh.
Let me see if I can summon it through my sinus issues and my cough, but I'm getting a headache.
Yes. You know, I was so excited for this episode when I heard the title, and I made also all these false assumptions that wound up not coming true. And this episode didn't even address the most fundamental truth in all of life, which is, of course, that Thanatos is Poindexter.
Poindexter is Thanatos.
Yes.
Now, I did find it interesting that the alternate title for this episode in Spanish was La Poindexter Gilde.
Oh, which, of course, means the Poindexter Gilde.
Yes. So, all of the actors that we're mentioning right now combined into a very good episode of Arrow, which came on the heels of a very good episode of Arrow. So two very good episodes back to back. And I don't think it's a coincidence, Nick, because it involved more of the original Team Arrow. We get Speedy back. We get Arsenal back, including his baseball cap. And they are just so much more interesting than Curtis, Renee, and Dinah.
Agreed.
As far
and
as the team.
This week especially, when they did choose to focus on Dinah and Curtis, it mostly worked because they weren't having them in constant conflict with original Team Arrow. They weren't having them bitch and moan and complain about everything that Ollie and Diggle and Felicity were doing. And so as a result, having them actually go off on their own and not really be, you know, tied at the hip to original Team Arrow and not be, you know, constantly at their heels, kind of made those characters more bearable. So I think it's best for all parties involved if they just drop the whole Civil War aspect of that the season has had. Now, one disappointing aspect is that, you know, a couple times in the episode, Nyssa made reference to the fact that she was married to Oliver, and Felicity is also married to Oliver, and I thought that there was a lot of storyline potential in going down that road, you know, exploring that dynamic, and so having their marriage, her and Oliver's marriage, annulled by the end of the episode was a bit disappointing for me, just because I feel like it's one of those things where, you know, that dynamic between she and Felicity really need to be shown rather than told. I think it definitely deserves,
yes,
potentially
storytelling
to be the very basis of season 7 and seasons 8, 9, and 10. But that's just, you know, my own reading of the situation.
You know, I agree. You know, I think Oliver converting to Mormonism could have been an element. I feel that, you know, maybe, you know, clearly there was a great deal of tension between the two,
mm-hmm,
between Felicity and Nyssa,
mm-hmm,
right?
I would agree.
And it led to some of the best scenes of the episode.
Right,
they were,
yes,
great scenes. Every time they would kind of snipe at each other and Nyssa would play around with her. But I think, like you, that we needed a little bit more of that in the episode. By a little bit, I mean a lot more of that, mm-hmm, in the episode. But all of that aside, I thought it was a great episode. Really good stuff.
Sorry.
Your thoughts?
Yeah, completely agree.
Yes,
love the hell out of it. And
so,
I would point out.
Oh,
I'd like to point out, and I, you know, not to get too deep into it, because we're going to have a moment here. But they made a point of saying that that Merlin intended for his heir to find the Lazarus Pits. That's all. That's all I'm gonna say about that.
Yeah, up there. So let's rank them for the week. I'll go first. I've got it number one, Arrow. Mm-hmm. I've got it number two, Legends. And I've got it number three, Black Lightning, although Black Lightning was excellent.
Exact same. Arrow 1, Legends 2, Black Lightning 3, all very good this week.
Yep. All right. So what better way to transition into our other continuing segment, the Rundown.
Welcome to the Rundown.
Wonderful. And I say that because our lead story is the renewal of all of the DC CW shows. That's right. All of them are coming back.
With the exception of iZombie, if you count that one. Has not yet been confirmed.
That has not yet been confirmed. It's on the bubble, so to speak. But we've got The Flash, Arrow, Legends, Supergirl, and Black Lightning all coming back next season. Great news. And I think one thing in particular, Nick, that stood out was a certain image that was tweeted out by Stephen Amell of E. Colin Donnell, who's a former Arrow cast member who portrayed the character Tommy Merlin in season one. And as you can tell, Nick is having sinus issues at the moment, but Tommy Merlin and Stephen Amell standing there in the picture, and they are both holding up their fingers to hold up seven fingers, indicating or implying season seven of Arrow, and implying perhaps that Colin Donnell could make an appearance in season four of Arrow.
Season seven
of Arrow. So, Nick, do you dare I even ask if you have any thoughts about that picture and the renewal of Arrow for season seven? You're going to be unbearable if it actually happens, and I want it to happen so bad, but. You are going to be unbearable, sir. Yes? Riveting audio here. From my
What else can I mean... Let's just let it play out and see what happens. It's far from a confirmation at this point, but.
So, Nick, do you think that this is an indication we may have our big bad for season seven of Arrow?
Oh, far be it from me to draw that assumption or conclusion. But, we'll see. We'll see what happens. That's all I can say is I don't want to make any assumptions, Greg, and I certainly don't want to say that any one person or individual has been advocating or saying it was going to happen or calling it for a long time. That's certainly not for me to say, quite frankly. So,
The news is mostly good here. We got our renewals. We also got news that Ava is going to be a series regular on Legends of Tomorrow next year, as will Constantine. So that is good news, getting two new characters to the Legends crew, which does make me worry that we may lose one or two along the way. But the news isn't all good, because we also got news that one of the original stars of Arrow, Willa Holland, who played Thea, is exiting Arrow. She is one of the show's original actors, appearing in all six seasons as a regular since 2012. And Mark Guggenheim, who's the co-showrunner, said that it was Willa Holland's idea to exit, that by the end of season four, she said she wanted to reduce her commitment to the show, and her contract apparently ends after season six. So they've known this was coming for a while, and they the Thanatos Guild episode kind of a way to seemingly write her off, at least for now. That doesn't mean that she can't come back, of course, and make guest appearances. We've seen that with many actors on this show. So we'll have to see what happens with all of that. But I'll definitely miss her on the show. I've enjoyed since she's been an active part again, but hard to blame an actor for wanting to go and explore other avenues after that many seasons.
Yeah, I completely understand it as well. You and I have talked about this. We felt for a while like the writers were kind of spinning their wheels in regards to the Thea character and didn't really know what they wanted to do with her. And so I think some time away will probably be for the best, as we've seen with other characters. Just because you go away doesn't mean you can't come back at some point. And if season 7 tells the story I think it's going to tell, I think it's a safe assumption that we will see Thea back for at least some episodes in season 7. So, sad to see her go, but I feel like probably past the right time, honestly.
Yes. Well, the right time never arrived for the long-talked-about Donald Glover-helmed Deadpool animated series for FX Network. Mm-hmm. That is because the network pulled the plug on the show before it ever saw the light of day. It looks like we're not going to get that series. FX and Marvel will continue their relationship through Legion. But the Deadpool show appears to be DOA. I was kind of interested in seeing what Donald Glover's take on Deadpool would be and what we would get out of that. Kind of unfortunate that this project's not taken off.
Yeah, it's especially weird when you consider the fact that, you know, Marvel is locked into a deal with FX for the purposes of producing Legion and ostensibly potentially any other X-Men related television shows, whether it be through Fox or FX. And Donald Glover is also locked into a deal still with FX, which originally was announced with the second season of Atlanta and Deadpool as the centerpieces of that agreement, with other projects that could potentially result from that. So interesting, right, that FX is in independent agreements with both parties still, but that a partnership between the three is no longer going to happen. Donald Glover did tweet out the hilarious fake script for the season finale that he wrote on the fly.
Right.
That kind of gave you a glimpse into the idea that he was a little bit perturbed by the whole situation and certainly was a project he wanted to work on. So who knows? Maybe he'll find life somewhere else. I doubt it. But I am still all for an adult-themed late-night FX Deadpool animated show. I think it's a great idea. I hope it happens somewhere, even though I'm not optimistic about the chances of it actually taking off at this point.
It's not the only project that has faced some issues with relation to the X-Men universe, because just this week we learned that – or last week, rather, we learned that 20th Century Fox has – again, postponed the theatrical releases of both X-Men Dark Phoenix and New Mutants. Dark Phoenix has moved from November 2, 2018 to February 14, 2019, while Bryan Singer's Bohemian Rhapsody movie will take over that November 2 spot. New Mutants will slide all the way from February to August of next year. Do you read anything into this, Nick?
The Phoenix thing is exceptionally strange because they had kind of started to ramp up the publicity. I think a few months back they had did the magazine rounds with a product on-set visit and that kind of thing. And I think it seemed like that one was mostly on track. And then this news came as a bit of a shock to me. New Mutants, that's less of a shock because the first delay was massive, as it was supposed to come out. What was it? February of this year originally, right? And then it got pushed all the way to February of next year, or whatever it was. And ostensibly, the reasoning we've heard behind that is that there's going to be extensive reshoots to the point of adding an entire character and an entire subplot and ratcheting up the horror elements. Apparently, from one of the rumors I read, the success of It at the box office has currently got still clamoring for teenage-focused horror, and New Mutants seems to be something that would lend itself well to that approach, given the trailers that we've already seen. Although, anytime you tinker with a movie this much in the middle of production, it concerns me somewhat. Granted, there are examples of it working out, such as Rogue One, and there are examples of it not working out, such as League. So, kind of have to wait and see what becomes of New Mutants. But I did find it interesting. There was a rumor that came out about a potential New Mutants post-credit scene that had already been shot.
Yes, John Hamm was at one time set to play Mr. Sinister, apparently.
Mm.
In a scene that was filmed for the New Mutants. However, the studio reportedly changed the plans, and now Antonio Banderas is slated to play an unspecified villain, which could very well be Mr. Sinister for all we know. I could see John Hamm as an ex-villain. What about you?
Yeah, I could too. I could also see Antonio Banderas as an ex-villain, so I have no issues with either of those things. You know, John Hamm, obviously his mutant power would have to be slapping people with his allegedly massive penis, but that's just...
You're saying he's got a low-key big ham.
I've heard he has a high-key big ham, but that's neither here nor there. I am for either of these things. I know John Hamm has something of a passionate following with his success in Mad Men, which I am still bewildered by the idea that David Sunday ever enjoyed Mad Men, but that's once again, neither here nor there. So, I'm for it if it happens. I'm not that bummed out if it doesn't happen. How about that? I have no dark feelings on John Hamm, I suppose I should say.
Another actor, big name actor, even bigger than John Hamm, although not in all ways,
allegedly,
who passed on a villainous role is, or missed out on a villainous role, is Matt Damon. Hey, quick cameo in Thor Ragnarok, of course, as a fake Loki. And apparently Marvel wanted him to be the villain in the Spider-Man Homecoming sequel. However, this is according to trade magazines and whatnot, the industry gossip, Matt Damon decided to pass on the role. We've also heard Matt Damon rumored for different comic book projects over time, and apparently he's just never found the right one. I think this would have been really cool because he's a great actor, but I think that there are probably other potential roles for him out there than a potentially one-off villain in a Spider-Man movie.
And see, I'm not necessarily convinced that the role would have been a one-off. I think for a young Spider-Man...
They would have had him play an Osborn?
I could have played a fantastic Norman Osborn, honestly.
Well, there's one big problem with that, Nick.
What's that?
Have you seen Matt Damon's hair?
Listen, if they can de-age Robert Downey Jr. by 30 years, who's to say they can't digitally create basketball hair?
Now you're thinking. See, now you're, initially you just dismissed my complaints about basketball hair. Now,
well, I've learned that dismissing...
Not only are they valid, not only are they valid, now you're saying... They need to actively be investing money in pursuing ways to make this digitally happen.
I didn't say that at all.
I like where this is at.
What I did was I attempted to dismiss them, and you refused to let it go. So I have to at least acknowledge your concerns about the basketball here at this point. So there they are. They could possibly CGI it. I don't care if they don't have basketball here, personally. While we say Matt Damon passed, remember, Michael Keaton reportedly passed like two or three different times on the role of the Vulture before eventually signing on. So
I think we need to forget about the Osbournes, and I think we need Stone Cold Steve Austin to play Kraven the Hunter. In a Spider-Man movie.
Why did this podcast turn into a Triple H promo all of a sudden? I don't quite understand.
Because you, Nick Duke, of the hard-traveling fanboys podcast, led me to this promo.
Oh, okay. Well, there you are. Your Triple H sounds a lot like the wheezing kid from Malcolm in the Middle who had to speak very quietly or very deliberately as well. But in any event, what else can we say about this other than
nothing?
Maybe it'll eventually come around, but, you know, who knows?
Could be. it's just too bad Ben Affleck didn't work out in the DC universe. Cause it would be great to see Matt Damon playing like a I don't know, a Jason Todd or a mm-hmm. or a Hush. Actually, much would be much better than Jason Todd. I don't know what I'm talking about. Jason Todd. Hush. He would have been awesome as Hush. I'm kind of in love with that idea, which is why I'm somewhat glad that he passed on this. But maybe he'll come back around to it. Captain Marvel is a movie that's coming up from the Marvel slate, and we're getting a little bit more information. We are getting word. We already know that Samuel L. Jackson's Nick Fury is going to be in it, probably a de-aged, two-eyed Nick Fury, mm-hmm. in fact. But we're also getting several other returns, including Clark Gregg as Agent Coulson, who has been relegated to Tahiti in on the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. show since his death in the Avengers movie. Or seeming death. He'll be back in this one as a younger version of himself. We'll also see the return of Lee Pace as Ronan the Accuser. He is going to be in the movie. Of course, he died in Guardians of the Galaxy. Spoiler alert. So he will be a younger version of himself. And his ally, Korath, played by Nick?
Jimon Hounsou.
Yes. So all of these characters are going to be younger versions of themselves. So interesting. What do you think of being a period piece, Nick?
I like the period piece idea. I mean, yes. You're going to have some sort of reasoning for Captain Marvel having some experience before she is introduced to the Avengers. And you don't want to just, you know, say, oh, she was there the entire time and you just didn't know it. So having her off in space, having her, you know, set 20 years ago, it makes a lot of sense from a lot of different levels. And I think it's really cool that they're going to explore some of these characters and perhaps, you know, show us how these characters came to be the versions we know from Guardians of the Galaxy. Maybe a less zealous Ronan, like a Ronan who maybe perhaps the events in this film will set him on the path to becoming the Ronan we met in Guardians of the Galaxy. And also, the return of Phil Coulson. And while it's a younger version, I understand that. Here's hoping that it marks the beginning of Clark Gregg's reintegration into the MCU proper, as opposed to just the MCU television universe.
Well, speaking of things that should be period pieces, Marvel's bringing back Fantastic Four in the comics.
Yay!
Marvel is doing this by attaching writer Dan Slott.
Boo!
And artist Sarah Pacelli.
Yay!
And it will feature all four original members of the Fantastic Four.
Boo!
Yes. Yes. So, yeah, this is part of Marvel's Fresh Start initiative.
Yes.
Not all new or all different, mm-mm. but it is a fresh start.
Nope.
And it's the return of the two uninteresting members of the Fantastic Four, along with the two interesting members of the Fantastic Four, and it's by Dan Slott. So, what better way to create a recipe for my disinterest?
Yep, not going to read it. I know a lot of people are excited that the Four are coming back. Good for those people. Good for people who enjoy Dan Slott comics. I myself do not. Hard pass.
Yep. There's something out there for everyone. And I know there's a lot of hardcore Fantastic Four out there, and I genuinely hope this book gives you what you're looking for and that you enjoy the writing from Mr. Slott. Frank Miller, speaking of writers who are unique in nature, Frank Miller has announced that he has 5 new projects with DC Comics. Now, the details of these are not all out yet, but we do know that one of them is Superman Year One, mm-hmm. which we've already talked about. A second story is an original graphic novel with artist Ben Caldwell that will star The Dark Knight Returns' Carrie Kelly, who, of course, was the first ever woman Robin.
And I also read somewhere that apparently that's going to be a young adult-focused title. A young adult-focused title from Frank Miller. Not a good idea, in my opinion.
Quite frankly. 3 other projects have not been announced that are part of this deal. The one thing that I'll say, Nick, is I hope out of all – now I'll be the first to admit I have not read Dark Knight 3.
Which he co-wrote. Did not write.
I hope that out of these projects, we get one, at least one out of the five.
We hope that Frank Miller can bat slowly or slightly below the Mendoza line, which thing? One out of
yes,
five.
Yes. If we can get one really good Frank Miller story out of this, I'll be fine with it. I'm fine with it. You know, I'm not against people getting work. You know, I don't have to read it.
What are the odds you think we actually get that?
That is not for me to say.
No, it is for you to say because I just asked you the question. It's an opinion-based show.
I would say that the odds would be somewhere along the odds of the Atlanta Braves making the playoffs this year.
Oh, ma.
Which is to say not determined at this time.
It's not impossible.
It's not, by goodness, impossible. But what's also not impossible is the resurrection of the Justice League line of comics at DC.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've finally gotten details of what will be spinning out of the No Justice event. All of these different Justice League titles under the Justice League banner. It will include three Justice League titles as well as other titles. And let's just try to hit these one after another.
We've already talked about the main title. Yeah, Snyder and Jim Chung doing and Jorge Jimenez doing Justice League. We know about that one.
We've got Justice League Dark, written by James Tynion IV, with art from Alvaro Lopez, Raul Fernandez, and Brad Anderson. This is about the creators of magic in the DC universe coming to take back, and it features a team of Detective Chimp,
yes,
Satana,
yes,
Man Bat,
don't give a shit,
Swamp Thing,
that's pretty cool,
and others, led by Wonder Woman.
Yeah, I'm down for this, man. This sounds James Tynion IV's work on Detective Comics has been very impressive to me. Getting to see Detective Chimp and Satana back together for the first time in my knowledge, anyway, since Infinite Crisis, I am all for this. I don't know necessarily that it's going to be on my pulse, but something that I'm going to definitely keep up with and probably read and trade. And by read and trade, I mean say I'm going to read and trade and then never actually read and trade.
Interesting to have Wonder Woman on the team. I'm not sure I really get that.
I think that makes some level of sense in terms of the story that's being presented as creators of magic, and that could easily be explained as Greek gods and perhaps her have some sort of familial tie.
It also makes it clear that this is a limited concept in terms of I don't think this is going to be a title that will run for 3-4 years. It's probably a 1 or 2 year title that will then eventually lead to a bringing back together of the status quo, if you will. But nonetheless, interesting. So we move from Justice League Dark to Justice League Odyssey.
Huh.
And this has got to be the weirdest of all the pitches. Got writer Josh Williamson and artist Chip John Sajic.
Now, see, that's the exciting part, is Sajic on a Justice League book. But
– oh, yes. Here's the lineup.
But –
This will feature Cyborg, Starfire,
uh-huh,
Asriel,
uh-huh,
Jessica Cruz,
uh-huh,
and Darkseid.
They
explore the universe in one of Brainiac's old headships, with flames painted on the side.
You know, you have obviously for the most of the segment, you have asked for my thoughts on things, and I've given you my thoughts. But I know that you, Greg, in particular, have some thoughts on this. Would you care to share those?
I would. I ain't got no time for Darkseid on no Justice League book. I don't understand painting flames on the side of a Brainiac skull ship. I don't know what the hell business Azrael has on a Justice League team. I've no issues with Jessica or Cyborg being on it. I have no issues with Starfire even being on it. But again, Darkseid is the greatest force of evil in DC Comics. This would be, Nick, this would be like putting the Joker on a Batman family team. This goes against some villains you can see as temporary good guys. I know the example that people are going to throw at me right away is Lex Luthor in Justice League. Worked out great, right? It was fun. It was a great book. But he is a human character that, again, has some redeeming qualities about him. in terms of, yes, he's a bastard and an asshole and all that stuff, but at the end of the day, bastard. His motivations – a bastard. His motivations are more than simply, I want to destroy all life. Darkseid literally wants to destroy all life and subjugate it to his will. But now he's going to help them to fight a greater evil than himself, and I don't like that. I've seen it before, and I didn't like it then either. We've seen Darkseid on seemingly work with the Force of Good before, and it usually hasn't been that great. But that being said, and this is clearly an homage to the Odyssey storyline back in the 80s, but I'll let it play out and see where it goes, but this team does nothing for me, and I'm not remotely interested in this concept. I hope that it's great. Maybe it will be, and I'll revisit it at that time when it comes. Although the art does sound
amazing. I was about to say, at the very least, it's going to be beautiful to look at. Sajic is one of the best artists going today, and I think they quickly realized that and bumped him up from Aquaman to a bit more high-profile assignment. Here's hoping that upward rise just continues for him.
Yes. And in more exciting news out of this lineup, we get, also operating out of the Hall of Justice, will be a new incarnation of the Titans. And this will continue to be written by Dan Abnett. And it will be it's described by Snyder as the Justice League's AAA farm team. And I love that description of the Titans. I think that lines up with what we get on Young Justice. The team will be led by Nightwing and Raven. No issues there. And it includes Beast Boy, Steel, and Miss Martian. Interesting still there. I don't know if that's going to be a new version of Steel or what.
I would have to think so, unless he's playing some sort of like perhaps the Red Tornado role from Young Justice. You know, we're kind of the Den Father or something like that. That's the only other thing I could think
of. These aren't the team, so they are a little bit older, you know, Nightwing and whatnot. Meanwhile, writer Adam Glass and artist Bernard Chang, who you may remember from Green Lantern Corps, will take over Teen Titans with number 20. Have a story that sends Robin out on his own, leading a team of rebellious young heroes,
and who's,
including
Damian. Is that Damian? Is that the Robin in question that we're led to believe?
Yes.
Who's on that team with Damian?
Kid Flash.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Red Arrow.
Sorry, just wanted you to. My mistake.
Red Arrow, who is Amico Quinn.
That is a decent, fair idea. Just a not too shabby idea. I wonder who had such an idea. Who could have come up with such an idea? Whoever it was, Greg, quite frankly, clearly has a hell of a mind for this business. That's all I'm saying.
Well, Benjamin Percy, the writer, does have a great mind for the business from when he introduced the concept.
Mm-hmm. 2 years ago.
In any event.
Peter David sponsored events.
Which may be returning in the near future.
I'm saying. It's just something to keep in mind, folks. Just something to consider when looking over this title is to think of certain ties it has to certain Place to Be Nation pop features and certain individuals who first pitched the idea and said it would be a great dynamic to explore and that it would work.
The book also certain individuals. Will feature completely new characters, including Lobo's daughter. Thoughts, Nick?
As excited as I am for an ongoing that will have both Damian and Amico on it, I got no time for any Lobo's daughter, and I have, controversially enough, I have very little time for New 52 Wally West. Not my bag, baby. This is probably, with Ben Percy leaving, this is probably going to mark my end as a Teen Titans reader.
And I should mention that all this is spinning out of the events of Dark Knight's Metal as well, which we haven't, you know, Nick, I think, has enough issues to read, but I have not read, so I maybe the Darkseid thing makes more sense than I'm giving it credit for, but I'm just not a fan of the concept. But also, we get Hawkman, a brand new Hawkman title in this banner that will that we've already talked about. I think getting his own book.
Yeah,
and also an unnamed.
Go ahead.
Yeah, there's also a named project from writer Brian Edward Hill that may spin out of his upcoming Detective Comics story, the team Batman and Black Lightning, which I would throw out there will probably be an Outsiders.
Yes, that is the rumor, is that the Outsiders will be making their return as part of this Justice League line to be overseen by Scott Snyder.
That's right. Monty Hall will be there.
Mm-hmm. And
Graham Nash.
And if you can get him away from the set of Dundee, the boot, where he's going to have a cameo role, Hogan might be there.
That's right. Paul Hogan will be there. So you've got Hogan and the Outsiders in one comic book. I mean, how can you pass that up? My God, Nick, I think we've reached the end of the line. I think we've reached Roadblock, the end of the line.
We have. What a name for an end of a show. Roadblock, the end of the line.
Yeah. But you know what they're doing? They're giving us the go home cue, Nick. But
Well, all I can hope is that at some point during this podcast, we have gotten our audience to come like fire.
Oh, that popped me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Well, there's a minute on the clock, Nick.
We're hoping to pop
them. What that means.
Oh, ho, 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 ho.
It's time for the wrestling minute. Let's go. Road to WrestleMania continues to kick off. We had a go-home Raw that was, not great. Not bad, not great. Somewhere in between. We have a go-home SmackDown that we haven't watched yet. And Nick, a shocking swerve of events, you bastard.
Now, wait just a moment. Wait just a moment. Let the public record show. There is still time, sir. There's still time for even you to make the wise decision and accompany me on the road to WrestleMania. But in all seriousness, I want to send a very special shout-out to the illustrious, the glorious, the just all-around stand-up guy, the manager, Todd Weber.
Manager.
He is wise in his years of experience and has went out of his way to make it possible for yours truly to make a WrestleMania trip this year, which I am all
10-second warning.
Now I am more excited about than I thought I would be. Cannot wait, and we'll report back. And I imagine next week will be more than just a wrestling minute.
Absolutely. That has been Wrestling Minute, ladies and gentlemen. And what do we have coming the folks' way in the next couple of weeks here, Nick?
That's a fantastic question that I can't entirely answer because we're kind of in something of a broadcasting flux right now because we are waiting with bated breath the release of the second installment of Place to Be Nation Comic Book Theater Watchmen. Our adaptation will continue. So at virtually any point, we could be preempted by that. But as of right now, tentatively, the plan is, John tentatively even, the plan is for us to do an off-the-page that's a little bit different than any off-the-page we've ever really done before. And that's because, for the first time ever, in my memory anyway, Greg, correct me if I'm wrong, we are going to attempt to take on a bit of music for off-the-page. For those who aren't aware, a couple of years back, DC Comics released two different compilation CDs entitled The Music of DC Comics and The Music of DC Comics Volume 2. The Music of DC Comics is various bits of music that have been used in DC media adaptations over the years. That could be a television show, that could be a movie, that could be a video game, it could be virtually anywhere that music may have appeared. And it's not just limited to stuff in the modern era. For example, theme songs, jingles, if you will, from the old 60s cartoons could be club. I'm not even really sure what
Aquaman.
That. Yes, a good callback to the early days of our podcast. So I'm not even sure what's on that first CD, but that is our tentative plan, is to take a look at that next week and then wrap up the month with a long book hunt on the one of Greg's a series that's near and dear to Greg's heart, that being the John Byrne Man of Steel that relaunched Superman in the post-crisis era. We thought it would be very appropriate to take a look at that, seeing as how Brian Michael Bendis is paying homage to that story by lifting the name for his own soft Superman relaunch coming up at the end of May. So thought that would be somewhat appropriate. So those two shows could come at any point. We could preempt about Place to Be Nation Comic Book Theater. It's kind of – we are at the whims of the manager himself, and whenever it comes, it comes. And hopefully it comes like fire.
It comes like fire, yeah. Now, yeah, that's a good point. Man of Steel is such an important story to the Breastular character.
Which I've never read, so that's going to be interesting. You know, long ago, the original concept for Long Book Hunters was stuff that I had never – one of us had never read. It's almost like us introducing things to each other. And this is one of those last great white whales out there that ties back to that original Long Book Hunters concept.
One of the issues is that the two of us, you know, we always meet up, of course, in the Vancouver studios. But we get here just in time to do the show.
Right.
Then immediately have to leave. And we live a good, you know, hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes apart. Both have busy lives, so it's hard to get books in each other's hands regularly. Right. So that's what's made it harder to follow the project to its fruition. But we are going to endeavor to do that when we can. So with all that being said, hope you enjoyed the show. Give us your feedback to what we've done, what we've talked about. Let us know what you'd like to hear in the future. And in the meantime, stay frosty, my friends. I don't know what that means. I don't know who says that. Nick, do you have a better sign-off line?
Let's see here. Let me think. Here's one. Okay, you go ahead then.
No, you go ahead.
Well, now I don't have one.
Whale? Fuck.
Hard traveling fanboys.